When I'm talking about solutions, I'm talking about finite, very limited approaches to what are very complex problems. So narrowly conceived fixes, that have been bounded, rendered solvable. They often are pursued with limited knowledge of a problem, a narrow set of tools, and a constrained sense of possibility.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Patricia Kullberg, and I'll be your host for the next hour. The voice you just heard was Julie Guthman, speaking about the role of Silicon Valley in crafting narrowly conceived and, of course, profitable technological fixes to complex social and environmental problems. Coming up, we'll hear a lot more from Dr. Guthman and about how ill-served we are by this approach. It's all thrills and no frills at KBOO once again. We have a host of special programming for you, including musical marathons. You can view the schedule at kboo.fm/ATNF4. That's kboo.fm/ATNF4. And while you're there, and if you feel so moved, please click on the donate button and support your community radio station. Perhaps no one has the ear of the would-be dictator in the White House better than the tech bros of Silicon Valley, with their technological schemes to fix everything and make buckets of money in the process. But do these technological fixes actually contribute to solving the most vexing and complicated problems we face, like climate change? Today, the Moles bring you a rebroadcast from Against the Grain. Sasha Lilly speaks with Julie Guthman, Professor Emerita at UC Santa Cruz, who argues that these so-called solutions are not strategies for the systemic changes needed, but rather a costly distraction. Worse, the Silicon Valley way of thinking has overtaken higher education, pushing a mindset of quick fixes in place of critical thinking and structural change. Lilly and Guthman talk about how this is played out in the fields of agriculture and food production. Against the Grain is a weekly radio show hosted and produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song on KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California. It's a program of ideas, in-depth analysis, and commentary on political, economic, social, and cultural issues important to radical thinking and activism. Now, here's Sasha Lilly with Julie Guthman.
Today on Against the Grain, our world is replete with problems, calling out for repair and change. Silicon Valley entrepreneurs have solutions at the ready, tech fixes and innovations that they claim will make a difference. Scholar Julie Guthman discusses the problem with such solutions and the mindset that has permeated institutions of higher learning, which reward the development of such fixes over critical thinking and systemic change. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The problems of our time can seem overwhelming and insurmountable. Those offering solutions, promising big without requiring systemic change, are lauded and often rewarded, especially in the world of tech. In The Problem with Solutions, Why Silicon Valley Can't Hack the Future of Food, Julie Guthman explores the trouble with entrepreneurs proffering tech fixes to deeply rooted environmental and social problems. She argues that such a mindset has spread to universities, where students are encouraged to come up with and sell such fixes. And she suggests that the consequences can be far-reaching, affecting whether young people emerge from academic institutions thinking of themselves as solution makers instead of activists. A geographer by training, Guthman is professor of community studies at the University of California at Santa Cruz and has spent her career examining the political economy of agriculture and food. Her other books include Wilted, Pathogens, Chemicals, and the Fragile Future of the Strawberry Industry, as well as Agrarian Dreams, The Paradox of Organic Farming in California. Julie, I would like to start by asking you how you define a solution, the source of your analysis and critique.
That's a super important question, of course, because I would be the last person to say that we shouldn't try to address the world's problems. When I'm talking about solutions, I'm talking about finite, very limited approaches to what are very complex problems. So narrowly conceived fixes that have been bounded, rendered solvable. They often are pursued with limited knowledge of a problem, a narrow set of tools, and a constrained sense of possibility.
We'll talk a lot about how we came to this moment, but do you feel like the drive toward these narrowly bounded solutions is especially intense right now when I think people have a sense of the world being beset by so many problems and so many of them seem far away from any kind of structural fix or change, systematic change. And so the idea that there might be a solution to something that, you know, might not solve everything, but could make a difference seems very emotionally appealing to many people.
I think that's exactly right. I think that, you know, it's so easy to throw our hands up in the face of all the many problems of the world. And particularly young people want to latch on to something that they can do that feels meaningful to address it. And so I do think that the kind of promulgation of solutions does have that sort of appeal. And it's tricky, too, because I think that it's impossible to bite off the whole, you know, all structural problems all at once. So you need to bite off specific things that you can do. But I think there's a difference between like choosing a strategy that's reflective of a moment when you can make a difference and build to something different versus coming up with a solution that's like, I've delivered a solution to this problem, but I've so narrowed the problem that it may not lead to anything more. So I think we always need to think about bite-sized pieces, but there's a difference between a strategy and a solution.
Well, we'll talk much more about the history of this kind of thinking, but your book focuses especially on narrowly defined solutions as they've been applied to food and agriculture, and the role of Silicon Valley tech in getting in on often profitable ways of coming up with solutions to the problems of food. And before we get into that, I wonder if you could just remind us, what are the problems of food and agriculture? What are the big questions that call out to be addressed in some way?
Well, they are big questions, and they're complex questions, and they're questions of environmental sustainability and climate change, as agriculture and food both being affected by climate change and contributing to it, and both affected by the legacy of industrial agriculture and contributing it to it. So climate change and sustainability, food security, animal welfare, in terms of environmental sustainability, questions of pesticide use and soil fertility and soil quality, pollution from agriculture. So these are very serious concerns and serious questions that do need addressing.
So before we turn to Silicon Valley's solutions to some of these very deep problems. Obviously, questions of food, questions of scarcity, questions of hunger are not new questions, and they have been understood in various ways, you know, at least since the early days of capitalism. Can you remind us, although obviously this is a long history, of the ways that the kind of solutions, as you define it, have been applied to agriculture and applied to food prior to our moment, going back several centuries?
Sure. I mean, in terms of agriculture, for a very long time, technology has been applied. Something that Silicon Valley doesn't always seem to recognize. There's a long history of technological introduction in agriculture, and most of it has been attempts to eliminate the risks of farming from, you know, from seasons and climatic differences to the risks of pests, to ensuring kind of more stability and standardization in agriculture. So having to make it easier to apply labor. So for instance, to make fruit all come ripe at the same time, or to breed for yield. So all these kind of solutions, they used to be mechanical and then they were more chemical and then biological, have all been introduced to try to make agriculture more like factory production in ways to be more standard, more regular, less vagaries of nature. But those same technologies that have made it in some sense easier for farming, of course, have led all the manner of environmental and human health problems, of soil depletion and pesticide toxicity and methane emissions, etc. So the very kind of technologies that have been helping agriculturalists have also created the very problems we need to address. In terms of food, it's a similar story in that a lot of innovation and or technological change in food has to, again, to make food more amenable to factory production, to supposedly make it more nutritious, but not necessarily, to make it more palatable or interesting to consumers, to attract consumers, to make it less prone to perishability, etc. So again, a long line of technologies that are supposed to make food more amenable to capitalist industrial processes, but again, have created some of the problems, more nutritionally debilitated food, food that's maybe produced with ingredients that are less than wholesome.
Can you remind our listeners of technology and agriculture in the mid to late 20th century, sort of setting the stage for more recent Silicon Valley interventions? Can you remind our listeners about the Green Revolution and the focus on productivity in agriculture?
So for a long time, agriculturalists and agricultural policymakers have been working with the assumption that to address hunger and to address the problems of agriculture, we need to produce more food. And that was most clearly taken up in the Green Revolution, which came at a time when there was severe poverty and food insecurity in the developing world, and in Mexico and Philippines and India. These are the places where the Green Revolution most took hold. And the technologies that were introduced were new seed varieties for grains, rice and maize, that would be more productive. They were short stashers, so they would breed, the plant would put more, less energy into growing and more into producing the grain. Anyways, all sorts of interventions that would make for more crop per acre. So this kind of intensification of getting more food, more crop out of a unit of production, under the presumption that that again would address hunger in the developing world. But of course, while the Green Revolution was really successful on those terms, in terms of increasing crop production, it had all sorts of externalities of more pesticide use, of overdrafting water, and of creating, it was supposed to be scale neutral, but indeed well-endowed farmers became more successful. A lot of people became landless, who then became hungry. And so one of the big lessons from the Green Revolution is more productivity actually did not create the outcome of overall reducing hunger. It created more inequality. But that's for so long been the model, and I continue to see it in my ongoing work of people working with farmers, you know, agricultural extension people, et cetera, believing that the problem is we don't produce enough food and we need to produce more food. And for so long, our overproduction of food has caused more problems than solved them.
And then just to, you know, clearly these questions can be seen in very narrowly technological terms about best practices for agriculture and the ways that seeds were developed and the use of pesticides or inputs and so on. And yet, really at the heart of this, as well as being a question about nature, these are social questions and political questions. And so I wanted to ask you, what is the underlying anxiety, really going back to Thomas Malthus in the turn of the 19th century, around fears of social unrest if these food questions are not solved?
Malthus, of course, is most known for portraying the problem with food, with growing populations, that we would outrun the basis of agriculture. We'd run out of land and there would be widespread hunger. Malthus was not a friend of the poor. He despised the poor. And so he kind of thought that might be okay. But neo-Malthusians are those that actually think, that don't really support this idea that the poor should be left to die, as Malthus kind of thought, but that we can use technology to make sure we don't outrun, that we can continue to produce in keeping with a growing population. And that very much remains the ways in which agricultural scientists and agricultural policymakers continue to think, that we need to produce more to make sure we don't run out of food. But it's also, and the Green Revolution was a piece of this, it's also been the idea that if the poor don't have enough food, they will become unruly. And so the Green Revolution in particular came about during the Red Revolutions of the mid-20th century in China and elsewhere, in Vietnam and elsewhere. And they were promulgated as kind of an antidote to the Red Revolutions, that we can produce enough food, we can solve the problem of poverty, of food poverty, without land reform, without restructuring, just by producing more. So these technologies have always had that kind of political bent to them of trying to come up with another way besides allowing more radical solutions of land reform or socialism or whatever to tamp down growing political unrest.
Geographer Julie Guthman is my guest. She's the author of The Problems with Solutions, Why Silicon Valley Can't Hack the Future of Food. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, I wanted to ask you, Julie, about how Silicon Valley has continued this tradition of bounded solutions within a kind of narrow capitalist logic to problems of food, problems of agriculture. But to do so requires, in a sense, knowing something about Silicon Valley itself. And I wonder if, as you do in your book, you could just give us a brief history of Silicon Valley and how it has sort of shifted the way technology has been formulated under contemporary American capitalism. What has Silicon Valley brought to that, and why has its history shaped it in that way?
Thanks for that question. So I don't know that most people know that Silicon Valley didn't begin as this kind of entrepreneurial haven for people to come up with whiz kids ideas of how to make life more convenient. I mean, Silicon Valley got its start with the war industry, and a lot of Silicon Valley activity was through Department of Defense contracts, so radar, computing technologies, etc., to support the military. But sometime in the 1960s or 70s, as war became less a central question and concern, they were kind of looking for new ways to apply these technologies and computing for business, and then personal computing became so important. And that's when we started to see the transition to personal computing and a kind of new culture of Silicon Valley, really based in this kind of strange combination of the counterculture and technological whiz kids and this kind of almost anti-intellectual culture where they just wanted to invent kind of new technologies to make life more convenient, which is a lot what Silicon Valley has produced. You know, more, if we think about it today, our computers can go faster. Now we don't need phone booths. We now have smartphones, and a lot of these technologies have been developed that kind of help smooth out the everyday inconveniences of life for both businesses and consumers. But sometime in the really in the early 2000s, with the impending problems of climate change and Al Gore's concern, Al Gore's intervention, he was in discussion with some Silicon Valley venture capitalists and investors. At some point, Silicon Valley kind of shifted and said, well, we've been so good at solving these other problems, maybe we can start solving the big problems of the world. And so at least some entrepreneurs and investors became kind of more focused on what they saw as major social problems or ecological problems. So one of the first interventions in the 2000s was clean tech, which was, focus on all sorts of technologies that might be more green, particularly in energy development. And that got a lot of hype in the early 2000s, then around 2000, that economic crash, clean tech kind of went away. And right on the heels of that is when Silicon Valley moved into food and agriculture. But I guess the main point here is that Silicon Valley has its bread and butter since it had so many military contracts, which it still does, but its bread and butter has been computing and data processing technologies for making everyday life more smooth. And more recently, the culture of hubris that we can solve so many problems has kind of turned toward more big worldly problems. And that's where the turn toward food and agriculture fits in.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, your host for the hour. As part of its All Thrills, No Frills special programming, KBOO hosted a number of shows featuring the history, art, culture, music, and politics of African Americans during Black History Month. If you missed those shows, you can still listen to them online by visiting kboo.fm/ATNF4. These include segments by The Old Mole on the African Film Fest, Surveillance in Oregon of Racial Justice Activists, Public Schools in the Making of Black Masculinity, and more. Please support your volunteer-powered community radio station, KBOO. Now, back to Sasha Lilly with Judith Guthman.
Is there also a connection between the geographic location of Silicon Valley and the fact that Northern California, the Bay Area, have, you know, you were talking about how Silicon Valley itself has complicated countercultural roots that wind around the capitalist culture of Silicon Valley. But also the region has been a region of alternative agriculture since at least the 1970s, which you have written about very insightfully in your book, Agrarian Dreams. Is that more than coincidence that Silicon Valley now turns to food and agriculture, or has so in the last several decades, in an area in which food and agriculture play such a central role? Agribusiness, of course, is enormous in California, but also this notion of innovation within food production.
I think that's a great question. And the answer is that surprisingly little of that has happened. When I was first doing the research that went into this book, which was a collaborative research project, by the way, that's one of the things we were hypothesizing, is that the alternative food culture that so permeated the Bay Area would be so influential on Silicon Valley's turn to food and agriculture. And they really exist kind of uncomfortably together, to be honest, and in part because some of the technologies that Silicon Valley is coming up with really do not intersect well at all with alternative agriculture movements. I mean, there are, once in a while, you'll see somebody pitching a soil amendment or something, but most of it has been pitching and producing foods that are anything but the kind of holistic whole food aesthetic of the alternative food movement, nor has the agricultural interventions been synergistic with the alternative food movement. And so the way in which food culture at all comes to play is when there, you know, one of the things we did for the research is we went to many, many, many of these pitch events where Silicon Valley entrepreneurs are pitching their new technologies to the public, but also to venture capitalists. And they often will have lavish food displays, maybe with regional food, but foodie culture plays a remarkably small role here, surprisingly.
That is interesting. Well, I wonder if you could tell us a bit about that particular culture of Silicon Valley. You just mentioned about these expos or these gatherings where startups pitch to venture capital their brilliant ideas of their solutions to the world's ills. Can you describe how that works and who the players are?
Yeah, the pitch culture is fascinating. And, you know, I didn't realize how much that was kind of defined what my research was about and what I was going to learn. And I didn't, you know, I've been studying food and agriculture for about 30 years now, and I haven't been studying Silicon Valley. So this was all very new to me. But basically, if anybody in the audience has ever watched HBO's Silicon Valley, it's very much what we witnessed in the research, which is there's these pitch events, and they are meant to display Silicon Valley's ingenuity, but also to vet products. And so typically an event will have, there'll be a big gathering of people. Sometimes they're down in the valley, and often they're in San Francisco, and there'll be a big gathering. Like I said, there'll often be lavish food displays of food and drink, and then they'll have pitchers. I mean, so basically entrepreneurs who are startups who will come up on the stage and do a 4-8 minute pitch on their innovation, how it's going to solve some worldly problem, and how they're also looking for venture capital money. And then there'll be questions and answers, often guided by a panel of judges who often come from venture capital. And then maybe in the back room, these entrepreneurs are meeting with venture capitalists. But the main actors are new entrepreneurs and venture capitalists whose mode of investment is looking for the one or two or three. I mean, they look for a small number of companies that they think they're really going to pay off. And so they do high risk investments into companies that they think will have worldly impact, which in part means that they're going to get big payouts. And so they play a huge role in defining the terms of what gets brought as a solution.
What can you give us some examples of the kind of solutions that get pitched at such places?
Yeah, so typically we'll see there'll be several alternative protein type innovations, and alternative protein innovations are supposed to replace animal production, but some of them are like the Impossible Burgers or Beyond Burgers that are reproduced plant-based burgers or seafood. And some are to be honest, there's a lot of alternative proteins, what we call alternative proteins, that are much less technologically interesting. Basically, snack bars with some odd protein substance in it, like maybe crickets or maybe recycled grain. So surprisingly, on the alternative protein side, a lot of the products that are being pitched are pretty low tech. And then you'll have some entrepreneurs that are pitching some sort of device or visualization system under the guise that if farmers could better view their field or collect data on their field, they would be able to make better decisions about what kind of pesticides to use or to reduce their use of pesticides or where the field needs treatment or if they can maybe reduce watering in a particular place. So these kind of visualization and data technologies are pitched with the idea that more knowledge for farmers will help them reduce their use of depleting or toxic materials. And then there'll be products like maybe refrigeration technologies, or maybe a lot of the research we did was before the pandemic. So there was a lot of like robotic deliveries machines that we thought, oh, that's never going to take off. And then who knows, the pandemic comes along and all of a sudden people want their food delivered with robots. But many of them are solutions to non-existent problems. And that's one of the issues. Or they're solutions to problems that are really poorly defined. So for instance, some of the protein bars are being pitched under the idea that they're going to solve malnutrition somehow. But the people who are going to purchase these protein bars are often people living in the United States or North America, Australia, who are relatively well off. And it's really unclear how that protein bar is going to fix the problem of malnutrition in the third world. So often you'll see these just real disconnects between what the problem that's being defined and what the solution can actually bring.
Well, tell us more about that. You know, you write in the book about one startup which very naively comes up with the idea that a certain plant, moringa, can be used to generate revenue for women in a particular place in Africa, without any sort of deeper understanding of the political economy of that area and the kinds of constraints that people operate under because of the system that they, you know, inhabit.
The story you're referring to was really one of the things that helped animate this book, because that's the first time I really thought about the problems with solutions coming through Silicon Valley. And you're referring to the story of a company, Cooley Cooley. It was founded by this woman who had gone to the Peace Corps in Niger and had been working in the Peace Corps and was suffering all sorts of problems with feeling weak herself. And so the women in the village she was in gave her this peanut butter paste called Cooley Cooley, and it was made of moringa leaves. And after she had that moringa leaf paste, she felt much better because she was getting protein. Because I guess she was a vegetarian, so she wasn't eating other sources of protein in the region. So that inspired her to think about importing moringa to the United States, where it could be used in snack bars or in protein drinks. Of course, that would be marketed to Whole Foods shoppers. While at the same time, she thought that she could solve the problems of the women in the village in which she was working, because they could now form a co-op and grow moringa for export production. So she had a more sophisticated idea than simply like dropping protein bars in Niger, which is what I first thought when I first heard it. It's like, wait, how are you going to solve malnutrition? She had a more sophisticated idea. She understood that the real problem for these women was a lack of income. So if they could export their moringa to the United States, that they would have a regular source of income. But of course, this is in keeping with many other development schemes where do-gooders have come to developing world locations and tried to encourage them to do market-based activities. And the market, of course, is very unstable, and often these things don't pay off. But anyway, she kept on bringing this model elsewhere and didn't really have a good understanding of the history of these sorts of development interventions. And also, for instance, in West Africa, often the men appropriate women's incomes. There's a whole literature on development interventions that she just wasn't attending to in coming up with this idea for this co-op.
You write in the book that there are multiple problems with solutions, and as this example shows, solutions being these sort of narrowly defined, bounded fixes that are supposed to make a big splash and impact without changing things on any systemic level. And I wanted to ask you more about that. One of the dimensions to what's wrong with these as you see it, you've just mentioned, which is this idea of the will to improve, this idea that you should act on behalf of others for their benefit without finding out if that's actually what those people want in the first place. But you also say that solutionism, which is not your term, is part of the issue. Can you tell us what solutionism is and why it is a problem?
Yeah, so the book is about the problem with solutions, right? And so based on other literature, I kind of parse out like three or four different tendencies if the problem with solutions. And so one is solutionism. And solutionism is coined by, well, I don't think it was coined by Evgeny Morozov. He's a tech critic, but he certainly uses it and has published on it. The way I use it in the book, I mean, you could talk about solutionism as the broader problem, but the way I use it in the book is to define interventions where the solution precedes the problem analysis. So, you know, I want to develop an app. I know I can develop an app to track my buying habits at the grocery store. What problem could that solve? Oh, maybe I can use that technology to convince people that they could buy more climate-friendly products. Let's just say something like that. So it's like, rather than saying with, boy, I want to address climate change, what could I possibly do? And what? How do I understand that problem? And what does it really need? It's starting with a solution that I can come up with. And so that's how I think about solutionism, where the solution, a technology, goes looking for a problem statement. And that's one of the ways you get this huge mismatch, because often that solution just can't possibly address the nature of the problem. And indeed, it's sometimes completely unrelated to it. And in part because the entrepreneurs are entrepreneurs. They want to come up, they know how to make an app for an iPhone. They don't know how to address climate change, and they're not in the position to do so because they're not working with on-the-ground movements addressing climate change. But that's not what they're doing. They're trying to sell their app, and they think that they – so they go looking for the problem to which their product can be a solution.
So in that vein, tell us about the notion of digital agricultural technologies – produced by Silicon Valley that are supposed to have some kind of benefit. What sort of solutions are we talking about here, and why do they fail for precisely the reasons you've just described?
Yeah, so I think a lot of it has to do with Silicon Valley's origins in computing and communication technologies and digital technologies. And so now they're moving into an area of food and agriculture which are so fundamentally biological, biophysical. I mean, food and agriculture technology are about dealing with the biology or biophysical, the soil of food production. And what can a digital technology based on computing and based on data management, data gathering, data analysis, what can it bring to that? And it's a real mismatch to me of the technology and the needs. And so, again, a lot of the digital technologies are geared toward enabling farmers to make different decisions or better decisions. And so they often are about allowing farmers to visualize their field or to provide data on climate or whatever, so the farmer again could make better decisions about what they're doing on the ground. And so they're assuming that farmers don't have sufficient knowledge. They're also, frankly, the digital technologies for farming really assume that farmers are operating on such a large scale that they wouldn't otherwise know what's going on in their fields. So that's what we're seeing in farming. In food, it's more of the same, like these apps. We see a lot of apps coming out that are just giving consumers information about what to buy, as if like they can look at your app rather than reading the label on the package of cereal to get more information. They're developed by an entrepreneur who has a particular technology they're comfortable with that may or may not address any serious problem.
Julie Guthman is my guest. We're discussing the problem with solutions, why Silicon Valley can't hack the future of food. She's professor of community studies at UC Santa Cruz. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio.
This is Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm interrupting our broadcast again to remind you that KBOO is hosting its annual All Thrills, No Frills special programming now through April 15. There will be a metal marathon on March 14 and a bluegrass marathon on March 29. All this and more. Check it out at kboo.fm/ATNF4. And please, if you can, donate to KBOO to keep community radio alive in Portland. Now back to Against the Grain.
What you're describing, the orientation of Silicon Valley toward what often turn out to be pretty underwhelming solutions that are supposed to be sort of the big thing, the big fix, that you argue is not just confined to the world of Silicon Valley, but actually has interpenetrated academic institutions, including your own, University of California, Santa Cruz. Can you tell us about how the narrowness of solutions has been embraced by universities and the consequences for the generation of ideas and critical analysis?
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the concerns that really motivated me to write this particular book as opposed to the research articles I was writing, because I was very concerned with the way that solution culture developed in Silicon Valley was being brought to young people, and particularly through universities. And so we're seeing this like proliferation of entrepreneurial contests throughout the United States and elsewhere, where students are emboldened to think that they have a big idea and they can be change makers through some sort of entrepreneurial solution. Not even necessarily entrepreneurial. I mean, some of these contests are not entrepreneurial, but they're still geared toward encouraging students to come up with an idea and trying to sell it. And a lot of the curricula of these contests are really, they imitate the pitch events. I mean, they're basically in teaching students how to make pitches for their ideas rather than actually carrying them out. And I mean, it's kind of stunning about this. I mean, they're not even encouraging students to research the problem. I mean, they're encouraging students to research the problem in the sense that they say you should use a couple statistics to support the problem, but they actually don't encourage students to dig deeply into the causes, including the structural causes of the worldly problems that the students are encouraged to address, and instead to come up with a big idea that they can pitch. And these kind of contests have proliferated in the United States at universities. Everybody I've talked to says, oh yeah, they have one of those at my university too. And so they're basically encouraging students to not work with existing organizations, to not do the intellectual work of coming up, of learning about how problems exist and thinking strategically about what might be done about them, but to kind of embrace the same sort of anti-intellectual underpinnings of Silicon Valley, this kind of can-do hubristic spirit of like, I don't really need to know this issue, I just should dig in and do something. And students, I think, sometimes feel very emboldened by this and they feel very empowered by it, but it's not necessarily what's needed. And the pitch events don't even ask them to think about how their solution might be received and in the communities in which they might bring it. So I find this really distressing. I think that there's one other thing I really want to say about this. Many of these programs and competitions are framed by the idea of get out of the classroom and do something. And I say this because they contrast so deeply with the curriculum of the major with which I've been working with for the last 21, 22 years, which is community studies, where our students do get out of the classroom to work on field studies, but we have them work with existing organizations and we have them learn about the problems they want to address. And when they go and work with existing organizations, they are actually trying to analyze how that organization tries to address a problem. So we have such a different mode of trying to get students involved in trying to in approaching the world's problems. And I'm just so struck by this kind of Silicon Valley model being so pervasive and desired.
Do you think that these programs like UC Berkeley's Big Ideas have an impact on the kinds of ideas that come out of universities and the ways that undergraduates see the world?
I don't know about the evidence on this. It's not something I've looked into. But considering how many of these programs there are and how many students enroll in them, there has to have a pretty huge impact. I think for many students, it ends up being a resume builder, frankly. And so, which is one of the issues, is like, who is this for, right? But so I can only compare with the impact I see with the major in which I work, community studies, in which students feel they come out maybe feeling that it's not easy. It's not easy to do social change, but they have more of a clear-eyed view of what it really takes, and they have a clear idea of what are the conditions of possibility for social change. And I think I can only speculate that many of the students coming out of these other kinds of programs are coming out with a better resume and possibly the idea that this is how you fix problems in these very delimited ways, which are giving deliverables that maybe funders, foundations, or venture capitalists love, but don't really address the serious problems.
Well, stepping back for a moment, we've been talking about how Silicon Valley has shaped thinking around fixing the problems of agriculture and food, questions of sustainability and equity and so on. And we've been talking a lot about the particulars of Silicon Valley, but I wanted to ask you if the problems with solutions, which is the title of your book, how you put it, the problems with solutions is in many ways the natural state of affairs in our neoliberal era. And if that's true, I wonder if you could remind our audience what precisely that would mean, how the last, five decades influences the kind of ideas that are then seen as acceptable or not for addressing problems.
I definitely think that solution culture has reflected and reproduce neoliberal ideas that entrepreneurial activity is where you can, win-win solutions, where you can do good and make money too, is the way to address problems in the world. And I also think that the neoliberalization of the university is really playing into this. I mean, universities are as many of us know, are underfunded, are particularly public universities, are looking to they've had to become entrepreneurial themselves to support their very heavy administrations, and are looking for ways to get money themselves, but also produce entrepreneurial citizens. So part of the neoliberal university is looking for funding pots, but it's also neoliberalism has also created this idea that students need to come out of college educations not with critical thinking skills, but with job prospects. And if a student can come out with an education in the STEM fields, they feel that they will have better job prospects, and the university is really encouraging that. And so this kind of technological fixing is like a way to kind of to give students an ability or a presumed ability to fix the world and sharpen their technological know-how and find employment in the world. So the influence of neoliberalism is profound on this in more ways than I'm even stating. At the same time, I'm not convinced we live in a neoliberal world anymore, but that's another question for another day. I think we're fighting between some sort of economic populism and neo-fascism, but that's another story.
Julie, let me end by asking you, how else might people take on the problems of our time? You argue that it's possible to recognize that structural, systematic change is necessary, while at the same time still taking more immediate action in the present. So what would that look like?
Yeah, so the term I kind of glommed onto as a way to think about it is the idea of response instead of solutions. So and this isn't my original idea, but I think it's a useful way to think with this, which is like response says, okay, here's a big problem. Let's understand the dimensions of it. Like, let's really dig into it and think about what kind of response it needs. And then think strategically about what part can be bitten off and addressed and mobilized around. I know that's very abstract, but the point is I think there's still, thinking about strategy helps us think about the doable chunks that's so attractive about solutions, but it's about using strategy in service of a larger agenda of how to fix a large structural problem. So I think that's how we need to think about how to move forward with getting what's attractive about solutions, which is the doable, with understanding that we need broad systemic change. And so how do we think about doing something that's going to steer the ship in another direction than reproduce the existing one and bite off those? And it changes all the time. Like right now, I'm very convinced the most important thing we can be doing politically is getting Kamala Harris elected. I'm certainly spending hours a week doing that. And of course, that's not going to solve everything, but it's very essential for stopping the neo-fascism threat, the neo-fascist threat, which is, I think we all your listeners know, is very present. So that, unfortunately, that's kind of a rearguard strategy because we're fighting so much, but to get us back to where we were 50 years ago with in terms of rights, etc. But what could be mobilized around that? So I'm digressing a bit here, but I think the point is rather than think about these finite solutions that you then move on to the next thing and you're absolved, the word root of solutions, you think about what are issues I really care about, who's working on them on the ground, what can I learn from them, and what kind of strategies can I employ to start steering the ship in another way that will then build towards some sort of structural change. Of course, that's abstract. And of course, it's like that's, you know, I'm not giving you any specific thing to do, but it's a different way of thinking. And that's what I'm asking my readers to do, is like not to fall into this idea that if you're grabbing onto a solution, you're doing good. Because, again, many of these solutions are not doing anything, and they're not doing good, and they may be detrimental.
Julie Guthman, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sasha. It was really wonderful for you to have me on the show.
Julie Guthman is professor of community studies at UC Santa Cruz, author of The Problem with Solutions, Why Silicon Valley Can't Hack the Future of Food. Her other books include Wilted, Pathogens, Chemicals, and the Fragile Future of the Strawberry Industry, as well as Agrarian Dreams, The Paradox of Organic Farming in California. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
That concludes our show for today. You've been listening to a rebroadcast from Against the Grain about the false promises of technological fixes. This show originally aired on August 28, 2024, on KPFA in Berkeley, California. I'm Patricia Kullberg, and I've been your host for the hour. One last reminder about this year's All Thrills, No Frills special programming through April 15 on KBOO Portland. We still have a couple of great musical marathons coming up. You can check it out at kboo.fm/ATNF4 and listen online to shows you might have missed for Black History Month, International Women's Day, and Mardi Gras Rock and Roll. Remember, too, that KBOO is only on the air because of listeners like you, and we thank you for your ongoing support.
Buy it, use it, break it, fix it, trash it, change it, mail, upgrade it, charge it, point it, zoom it, press it, snap it, work it, quick erase it, write it, cut it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, quick rewrite it, plug it, play it, burn it, rip it, drag it, drop it, zip and zip it, lock it, fill it, curl it, find it, view it.
I'm going to leave you this morning with a song called Technologic by Daft Punk. Thanks for listening.
Send it, fax, rename it, touch it, ring it, pay it, watch it, turn it, leave it, start, format it. Technologic, 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 technologic. Buy it, use it, break it, fix it, trash it, change it, melt.